This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Now, will saggy pants still be big in street culture?
Well, they have to be big. If they were small, as you want to be said.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Johnny Depp of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey, how you doing, babe?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. I like that. That's really
You know why I say that? So Johnny Depp, I understand, Golden Globes nominated for what best comedy and best drama? Is that it or something like that? Best actor, best supporting actor? What do we have going on here? We don't know. Two nominations for two different movies. All right. Long story short.
But one of the movies is A Tourist, which is apparently just atrocious.
Right, which I haven't seen. And I guess you haven't seen either.
I don't think it's yet.
Can I make my point, people?
Was there a point?
Yes. So, I mean, Rick's has always been strong in the writing books category, but this year he's also strong in the writing blog post category. That was a long, stretched out analogy. Thanks to you guys.
Very long, very stretched.
Woo. So, yeah, this is the time of year when all these movie lists come out and I realize I haven't seen any of them. Or we usually all have seen one of them. And
you
so,
saw Toy Story 3?
No, I didn't see Toy Story 3.
You didn't take Nico to see Toy Story 3?
No, yeah, I haven't taken Nico to see a movie in a theater yet.
You're like one of those horrible parents from like the Disney films.
Come on, I think he'll be ready soon.
He's going to be scarred.
It's dark. It's a little scary for kids to be in a movie theater, but I think he's probably ready pretty soon. We have been watching some stuff at home via Netflix.
Like?
A little advertisement there for Netflix.
What have you been watching?
Especially since we'd like to get some money from Reed Hastings. Did I mention Netflix? It's very nifty.
Mike, why don't you just watch something when it comes on cable instead of having to go through the whole Netflix?
Because I don't have cable, because who needs cable when you got Netflix?
And because you were no longer able to steal it after a point. Wasn't that the real dilemma?
They turned it off. Something about not ever paying for it. But anyway, I tried to pay. I called them. I said, you're giving me free cable. I haven't paid. You're not sending me a bill, but I was put on hold for a long time. All right, now all the audience knows. Okay, hey, it may be the holidays, but we are going strong. Lots to cover in the education policy world. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Question number one. Fordham's new report entitled Are Bad Schools Immortal? Just released this week. So guys, are bad schools immortal? And because we probably need a follow-up to that, does this prove that turnarounds are hopeless?
So Rick, I'm not sure if you've seen this report yet or given it time to peruse it, to sip it in, to suck in, the marrow.
But I like to marinate in a report myself.
The marinate. Ooh, I like that. Although, ooh, that image. Okay, never mind. But all right, so are bad schools immortal? This new report by Fordham. What we looked
who actually wrote it, Mike? You make it sound like Fordham is the, which always bothers me. Who did the hard work?
No, only because Rick. You guys are marketing. That's what happens when we do. Rick does a report for us. David Stite did this report for Fordham.
Nice job, big guy.
He did a very good job. Basis policy research, and what he did is he looked into the lowest performing schools in 10 states. Some of these are charter schools. Actually, a lot of them are charter schools. Some were traditional district schools, and we tracked them over the course of 5 years. And we wanted to see, did they get much better? Now, all we could do is look at proficiency rates. So that's obviously a big limitation. We can't look at value added. So it's possible that some of these schools were making big value added gains. Possible, not likely, but possible. Well, what do you find out? Almost all of the schools are still open and almost all of them still suck. So that was, I think, as Amber, our research director,
but now
put
my,
it in the report.
So let's stay with this. So what we know is that these schools, they stink if it's in terms of kids hitting the proficiency
that's
bar.
That's right.
But we know that a lot of these schools probably serve at-risk populations.
Absolutely.
Kids who come to school way behind the eight ball.
Yes.
So they could, year in, year out, be moving their kids a grade level and a half, two grade levels, and they would still show up in a study like this
right.
as non-improving.
That's correct.
Okay.
So that's a huge limitation. We looked at, compared the district schools to the charter schools, and the charter sector was somewhat more likely to have schools be shut down. So that's good news for charters, although it wasn't overwhelming. 19% of these bad schools shut down the charter sector compared to 11% in the traditional district sector. There were some interesting state-by-state variations. Ohio actually has quite a few shutdowns in both sectors. Arizona has actually gotten serious about closing down bad charter schools. Texas, meanwhile, is still the Wild West of the charter school movement. Lots of bad charters. They have not gone away.
Well, when you say Ohio shut down in both sectors, lousy schools? Do you know what's going on? Or are these consolidations in Ohio?
On the district side, we think it's largely because of consolidations. And they've had a lot of school construction. And as they've built new buildings, they've done some consolidating. And they'll get rid of the bad schools. Of course, they've lost population in Ohio. Charter schools, you know, it's a mix. Some closed down for academic reasons. Plenty that have gone under for financial reasons. But, you know, if they're bad schools, so much the better. But now here's, you know, to Daniela's question, you know, what we find is almost none of these schools have made huge gains. And look, the Secretary of Education.
But by gains, you mean.
Right. But here's the key thing is that Arne Duncan has also been defining in their school improvement grant stuff that schools would need to make big gains in their proficiency rates in order to be considered turnarounds. We looked at the same thing and it almost never happens.
And what's the takeaway there?
Rick, you are to answer questions. You're not to ask the question. I'm just teasing. No, so the question is, look, you know, obviously this is a new round of efforts with turnarounds. Maybe this new stuff that people are doing is going to make a difference. I'm skeptical. I mean, if you look back on the whole, these bad schools, they don't get better. You know, this has been under the era of No Child Left Behind. That hasn't seemed to help. And most importantly, in the charter school sector, where there are no constraints, no union contracts, you can hire and fire at will, all those sorts of things that you would like to have in a turnaround situation, the charter sector has it, and even those charter schools almost never get better.
You know, and just one data point here that's consistent is Tom Lovelace's study from, I think it was earlier this year, looking back at 25 plus years of California.
Yep.
You look at where schools ranked on the API a quarter century ago and where they ranked today, and he found remarkably little movement by schools on the bottom.
That's right. Okay, Daniela, second question.
Question number two, then. Kathy Black has been all over the New York City news of late. Do we have any more reasons to believe that she knows what she's doing?
Rick, let's get it inside the black box.
Oh, I like that.
Thank you. So what do you think about Kathy Black?
You know, I don't know her. I've got no real basis on which to judge her. What I have said over and over is neither the Bloomberg administration nor Black have given any explanation of how her skills are a good match for what New York City needs. Sounds like she's a generic CEO.
Mm-hmm.
The way she's been talked about by Bloomberg sounds like if he grabbed any executive off of the island of Manhattan, they'd be an equally appropriate choice.
And you know, Rick, I don't buy this argument. Maybe you've made the argument. I don't know that all you need in a CEO for a schools is a strong manager. I mean, it's not just about managing a large bureaucracy. In a public role, it's also about the sort of legislative leadership, right? I mean, you got to make a case to the public. You got to deal with legislators. You know, you've got to have some policy sense to you.
I mean, Klein, I mean, for me, people said, oh, he taught for a couple of years or what have you when he was a kid. The most relevant experience I think Klein had was leading the antitrust stuff against Microsoft back in the 90s for the Clinton administration.
Right.
He, you know, he'd run Bertelsmann, so he had understood what it meant to negotiate as a high profile, high visibility executive in the public and private space and understood what kinds of constraints were in place. Nothing in Black's resume, nothing in how folks have talked about her strengths tell me that, yep, she, you know, and again, maybe she does, but boy, oh boy, I'd be a lot more confident if they were explaining this.
Yeah, no, and that's right. Maybe she'll turn out to be great, but you know, she was interviewed. The New York Daily News had some great questions on what she thinks about what to do about the release of teachers' effectiveness ratings, and you could hear in the interview she's really wrestling with these questions. There's the right things to be wrestling with, but it also get the sense that this is probably the first time she's thought about this question.
Absolutely, that was exactly my response. Josh Greenman sent that around, and she actually came out where I came out for the most part that I've consistently said, look, the LA Times approach is not one that I'm fond of. I'm in favor of measuring teacher performance, but not in favor of putting it up on billboards because I don't think that's a useful way to make good decisions. So actually, I kind of agreed with where she was coming from. But you're right. When you looked at her comments, it wasn't something she had thought about and she was explaining.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like it was something she was thinking about for perhaps the first time.
Right. Okay. Topic number three, Daniela.
The parent trigger. Is it worth all the excitement?
I don't know. Is this the parent trigger on the new Xbox Kinect where parents get to...
The parent trigger as the California law that recently got passed.
Right. That parent trigger. Okay. That one's worth less excitement to me.
Okay.
By the way, Rick, you already had the Wii. I don't see why you needed the Xbox Kinect.
Wii's kind of weak. I decided.
You are a sucker for corporate America, just always dangling that new toy out in front of you, convincing you that and I'm sure that Xbox Kinect is not as good as it could have been. They're probably keeping features back so that a year from now, you're going to feel like you need to buy the next thing.
Planned obsolescence, baby.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's true. On the other hand, like the Wii, the problem is you can't really do like Madden because it's just with like the little hand controls, and it loses a lot of the strategy and interest. Whereas the Xbox is going to be kind of, it's bimodal. You can either do the Kinect stuff, or you still got the old school hand controllers.
All right. So the Trigger, Ala, California.
Right,
I mean, a lot of excitement. I mean, all kinds of reformers, a Wall Street Journal editorial page saying this is the next big thing. This is going to transform American education. I don't know. Am I getting cynical? I'm just like, eh.
I still don't understand the journal's logic on why this is so transformative.
It's power to the parents. Uh-huh. That's exciting. They get to take it into their own hands,
right? Which I like.
But the question is, what? So they pull the trigger, and then what?
Exactly.
How do we know that this is going to actually come out right at that point?
I mean, so are they? You know, so they say, hey, we want to see new leadership at the school. Doesn't make clear to me how it's going to be any easier to recruit good teachers.
Right.
Not clear to me how you're going to be any more likely to bring in a strong curriculum.
Right.
Doesn't make it clear to me that they're going to sign up for really effective disciplinary model.
Right.
Sounds to me like, you know, it's so many turnaround efforts of the past where you say, let's do something different.
Yeah. And, you know, it did make me think of the old local school councils. Well, not old, I guess they're still there in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And some of the challenges they've run into there, where there have been cases where, you know, the parent-controlled councils just want to get somebody from their community to be the principal.
Well, even worse, particularly given these parent triggers are for, you know, relevant to low-performing schools in the worst-served communities. Tony Brikes worked back on the Chicago school councils 15 years ago. Pointed out that the council seemed to work pretty well when you had educated parents in effective school communities, but the council seemed to work least well when you had broken families, largely uneducated parents, and troubled schools,
right?
Which is precisely the place is most likely to use a parent trigger.
Right. I mean, you know, you'd have a mostly black school with a Hispanic principal who was doing a great job who would get fired because the local school council wanted to bring in a black principal, that sort of thing.
But more likely, it's just, you know, we're dealing with parents who, you know, have a lot on their plate. They don't necessarily have a lot of familiarity or expertise in the education space. So it's terrific to give them an opportunity to flush the old. But I'm, you know, it's kind of like this Kathy Black scenario. I don't have any confidence that what they're going to bring in is necessarily going to, you know, is going to be any good.
All right. That's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Nice playing, Rick. Next up, everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back. What you got for us this
week?
Hey,
Mike, how are you? Boy, no, hi, how are you? Just right into it,
I know,
I guess,
Mike,
huh?
You're all business, baby. Here she is.
Oh, I do an intro where I'm all nice and warm welcoming, and you all say, do it over.
That's true.
Right. Mike,
I just want our listeners to know that Mike's initial intro made him sound a little bit like a perv.
Yes.
It was like, Amber.
Takes one to know one, Rick.
Oh. We are going long today, aren't we? We're just in that happy holiday mood.
Yeah,
so this week, we have the preliminary findings from the $45 million Gates-funded study, The Measures of Effective Teaching, which intends to uncover the most predictive measures of effective teaching so that more reliable evaluation and feedback processes can presumably be put into place. Analysts plan to examine teacher effectiveness through student achievement data in math and reading for grades 4 through 8, classroom observations, teacher content knowledge, student perceptions and teacher perceptions, but this first report only has achievement data and student survey responses. Three big findings from five major school districts. First, when both measures are combined, they are fairly strong predictors of teacher effectiveness. More specifically, in every grade and subject, a teacher's past track record of value added is a strong predictor of achievement gains in their classes and in other academic years, so when they teach multiple classes. And while analysts found that value added fluctuates, given all the debate, from class to class and year to year, they conclude that its volatility does not undercut its overall usefulness. Second, teachers had larger effects on math achievement than in reading, and researchers are trying to uncover why. Third, students know effective teaching when they experience it. I thought this was really interesting. Their perceptions of their teachers remain stable across the different classes a teacher teaches. Their views specifically on whether a teacher controls the classroom, challenges students with rigorous work, and helps them learn from their mistakes were highly correlated with value added. So finally, takeaway, adding student feedback as an additional measure of teacher effectiveness is reliable and inexpensive and warrants consideration, they say.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So we do this in K-12, right? I mean, now in higher ed, and we don't do it in K-12. And these, it was surprising because these
Wait, what do we do in higher ed? Student
evaluations. You know, you always have to fill out your little evaluation.
Yeah, but nobody uses that seriously for 10-year promotion. No, God, no.
Really? Like, it's always in that big fat... At UVA, you didn't have like a big fat section on that, but they don't really care about it?
You generally disregard it. Partly because there's this problem that it's the groovy cookie teachers. Mm. I mean, part of what, you know, the Gates folks have tried to do, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, as folks weigh in on this, is get away from do you like the teacher?
Right.
Was the teacher engaging? And actually try to ask a battery of questions about specifics about your classroom. Which is a more probably a more useful way to get at something that matters.
Yeah. So I wasn't familiar with this tripod. It's Ron Ferguson's measure at Harvard. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's fairly well regarded, and all the questions were in there, and yeah, they weren't that way at all. So and you think, wow, fourth grader can answer these questions,
and is that right? They went all the way down to fourth grade.
Fourth and eighth grade. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're really pretty simple questions. It's
and they've been tried and retried, and you know, I mean, they've been testing this instrument for years. So yeah, it's interesting.
I have one question. Is this the most expensive study in the history of the world?
$45 million Can't be.
You think there's other... I mean, there's some federal studies that have been even more.
Studies.
But this is a lot. I mean, what happens one day if Bill Gates just decides he's done with education? I mean, there are a lot of people in this town and throughout the country who are earning a living off that Gates paycheck.
Indeed.
It's, yeah. And I don't know. People are raising some questions about that that are probably worth raising. All right. So we've got these. We're going to find out later this spring whether there's some of these other things correlate with the value-added achievement, like if they can look at what teachers are actually doing in the classroom and correlate
some of
that.
Yeah, those videos with a cool camera and classroom observations are coming in April. I guess that's when the next report is. So
you know, but your description of it reminded me of the TFA book that came out last year, that Teaching as Leadership, and that metaphor, that sort of, you know, if you are a strong leader, you know, then that is the kind of basis for being a good teacher. And that some of what you're saying kind of carries out throughout the different classes and kind of having a presence and control of the class and, you know, challenging the kids. I mean, it seems like there's some, you know, validity to that idea.
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing, right? I mean, this is also Doug Lamov stuff, the Teach Like a Champion. That, and what's fascinating to me is that ed schools for decades have resisted doing these kinds of things. Right. Teaching teachers how to take control of a classroom is something that is frowned upon because that's being the sage on a stage.
Right.
Teachers actually using their voice as a device to try to get kids disciplined. The behavioral stuff that seems to be consistently effective is what you get the most pushback on ed schools, which instead embrace the stuff that is really hard to figure out. Whether you're doing it well or whether it makes a lick of difference.
And I remember I used to think, well, you just pick that stuff up through experience. You know, it seems to be this attitude, once you're in 2 or 3 years, you pick up. But I mean, it can be taught. You know, it's not sink or swim your first or second year, which is the way a lot of ed schools approach it.
And how are you going to pick it up if you're spending all your time by yourself in your own classroom with the kids? I mean, you're not going to necessarily learn the right way to project your voice or to take control.
You know, but this is what's just so interesting to me about this stuff is how the ed schools are going to react to this. I mean, they'll presumably say through this clinical residency push, courtesy of Ankate, yeah, that's what we're going to do. Frankly, I'm not all that confident that faculty at ed schools actually want to do this or that they're actually, you know, that they feel comfortable, you know, either embracing that or that they'll do it well.
Because it feels like vocational training and they don't want to do vocational
training. Which we said in our cracks in the Ivory Tower report.
We did. So we should just cut them out of the equation and just send teachers to community colleges to get this kind of training.
Why to community colleges?
Well, because at least there they wouldn't have any qualms. They wouldn't think it's below them to teach this kind of vocational concrete skills.
Yeah, they would think it's below them to actually have to worry about whether you're adding value. They're going to show up as adjuncts. Nah, let's cut them out altogether. Let's let Doug Lamov and Tom Kane, whoever else wants to start to set up standalone shops, and let them start to become the trainers.
All right. Well, very interesting. What's
very
the
interesting.
Song that goes
it's
along?
It's kind of a stretch, but work with me here. So we're talking about how students speak truth about teachers. We have a song about how kids speak the truth about parents in Cheap Trick's Surrender.
Mommy's all right. Daddy's all right. They just seem a little weird.
So, Rick, was it me, or did that song have nothing to do with the study that Amber just told us about?
I got to say, I'm not sure what's going on with your quality control process here, babe. I'm like, the title doesn't fit. I think viewers who listen exquisitely carefully might be able to pull something out. But
I don't know.
I'm just saying that.
I mean, look, I understand. I mean, it seems like Amber, she took the time. She read the study. But then I think maybe, you know, she's kind of busy
with
the holidays.
It's a good song. I mean, don't get me wrong. I dig the song. Mom is all right. Dad is all right. So I dig that stuff. But just AMS didn't fit. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. I'll try harder. All right. She's going to try harder next time. All right. Well, we'd like to welcome back to the show Chris Irvine with his What's Up With That?
Yeah! Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you want to chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that?
What you got for us this week?
With the onset of the early 90s came a lot of changes in the United States. The rapidly emerging hip-hop movement brought with it a culture embracing oversized pants worn well below the waist. The early 90s also introduced us to a variety of laughable sitcom characters, none more recognizable than Steve Urkel, the nerdy, thick glasses and flood pants wearing star of ABC's Family Matters. While Urkel and the Winslows went by the wayside at the end of the 1990s, the rap-inspired saggy pants fad was as popular as ever. Much to the chagrin of teachers and administrators, this fashion craze seems not to be phased out as time goes on. Saggy pants are timeless, but Urkel is not. What's up with that? Bobby White, principal at Westside Middle School in Memphis, Tennessee, decided to use pop culture to fight pop culture. As a means of enforcing his no saggy pants rule, White and other faculty carry around zip ties and use them to fasten the pants well above the waist of anyone caught sagging their pants. The action quickly became known among students as being Urkeled, since teachers would zip tie students' pants to a level alike to the formal fictional television character. After a few weeks, the teachers found that the policy to be remarkably effective. One teacher reported the number of students he Urkeled dropping from 80 to 18 after only 5 weeks. Hats off to Principal White for coming up with a lighthearted, creative, yet incredibly successful reform addressing a problem at his school. For this week, at least, White's ingenious policy leaves only the saggy pants wearing students of Westside Middle School wondering, what's up with that?
Nice. So I'm surprised and impressed that these students would stand there and let the guys zip tie their pants up.
They could probably get a lawyer and push back on that. It's true.
Well, I'm surprised the kids want to just shove the teacher and walk off. Yeah. And I'm glad it's impressive that they got a school culture where the kids stand there and let their pants get Urkeled.
You know, Chris raises a good question, though. I mean, this is a fad that has lasted a long time now. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it about sagging pants?
It's the whole prison thing.
Is that it? That's the reference that they're making.
Apparently, sagging pants relates to like what role you play in a same sex relationship in prison. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it kind of percolated to street culture. And now it's just deeply enshrined in deep culture, street culture.
Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm. What's up with that, Rick?
First of all, interesting information. But wait. So I would assume that then by that analogy, what? That the tough guys on the street are saying that they are kind of like gay?
Actually, no. I assume it's the other side of the world. This is all, you know, anthropology I picked up off of like the Learning Network or something. I don't know.
Okay, we are way beyond our heads now.
Listeners who are interested should go hit Wikipedia. I'm sure the information will be sharp and reliable.
All right. Well, yes. Well, maybe we can do some predictions for 2011. And one will be, you know, will saggy pants still be big in street culture?
Well, they have to be big. If they were small, they wouldn't have said.
Rick, he's been really on today. All right. Well, that is all the time we got, especially today after we bantered. I think this show might have gone on for 45 minutes. If not, listeners, that's because Joe did a lot of extensive editing. Thank you, Joe. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.